Thank you very much. I think most of you will know where to find the book of Job, which you're anticipating. And if you would like to turn there in preparation and anticipation and expectancy, then we can start to move ahead. So I better do the same myself and open at the book of Job. You must be aware, of course, that in dealing with the book of Job, we're going to tackle the problem of suffering. I believe this is one of the greatest problems from the point of view, philosophical point of view, from the point of view of communicating the gospel, that we have on our hands. And I believe a deeper understanding of the answer that the Bible does give to suffering, not just the bland answer, it's all in the mysteries and you'll never understand it and it's the purposes of God and it's something we'll never work out. But I mean the answer that the Bible does seriously tackle to meet this problem of suffering. It's only as we, particularly as Bible-believing Christians, get to grips with it and start to have a coherent message, including the suffering that exists in the 21st century, which is colossal, that we're going to find a certain section of the community, at least, if not all of it, is willing to listen to our message. There needs to be an answer. And the answer is not to be palmed off with some trite sort of response. Well, somehow it's all in the mind and the will of God. That maybe has dominated the scene for centuries because of a particular viewpoint, which I'm quite aware, probably you're aware that we don't espouse in Ichthus. But I believe that it's not just an Ichthus problem, but theologians, scholars all over the world are seeking to tackle at a greater level this particular issue than maybe any other subject at the moment, because we need to have something to say. The more that the suffering of the world is brought onto our doorstep, the more hideous that it is seen to be in the way that people are tormented in this world. And sometimes it seems totally unjust. And the innocent suffering is the great, what we might call, theological problem of theodicy, that is the justice of God. That is something that we have to have something to say about if we're going to have an adequate message for the world. It isn't so much that there's never been an inquiry into these areas of life before. Going right the way back to the actual ethos of the book of Job itself, there have been many of those in the ancient world who've tried to tackle the apparent injustice of God in the unjust world in which we live, and the problem of suffering which ensues from that view. It is not just one that has arisen in the 21st century, but is particularly poignant for the Christian camp in the 21st century, because we are unwilling to accept any longer that God ordains that the sorts of things that, say, Greg Boyd begins his book with, coming from Friedlander's, was it, statement, you remember, about that girl of 12 years of age in a who a Nazi officer just looked at her eyes, 12-year-old Jewish girl, and said, "What beautiful eyes," and on the spot tore them out to make rings. That kind of complete, random, irresponsible, meaningless, totally meaningless sort of injustice, which screams out of us and says, "Where is God in this sort of situation? What kind of a God made this sort of world?" Random, wanton pain and suffering. We've got to get a deeper answer than heretofore. I don't know at the end of 4 days whether we will feel that we have, but we do need to keep pursuing these areas of inquiry so that we've got something adequate to say about that. Now, of course, the book of Job is a particular sort of suffering. It is a very, very deep and profound aspect of suffering. But as we look into it, we're going to find that we're tackling different areas of suffering as well. The suffering which, of course, is inevitable, that there needs to be some sort of suffering in the world for self-preservation. If you don't feel pain when your hand goes near the fire, if you don't feel a bit giddy when you stand on the top of a mountain, we act foolishly and we destroy ourselves. A certain degree of pain is necessary. But the misuse of pain too, because pain comes upon us and we put it upon others, is therefore something that we have to start to think about. Also, if we disobey the basic structures of the universe and we eat wrong things, throw ourselves over precipices, it is inevitable that a certain amount of pain will ensue. and therefore pain comes as a response to irresponsible living. These are different areas. Sometimes God speaks to us through pain. We're going to find that as we look at the book of Job and find that God reveals Jesus to us in the book of Job, because pain concentrates and focuses us. C.S. Lewis once says that God speaks in our conscience, he speaks through other people's voices, he speaks through the word of God, but he speaks loudly and shouts at us when we are in the place of pain. That maybe is true, it is true to a large degree, but many of us when we're in pain, physical pain, if you've been through intense physical pain, you know sometimes it blots out almost everything, including the voice of God. So we've got to have, as I say, a deeper and a deeper grasp of all the things that are happening in the world at the present time. Job's suffering is a particular type, but in investigating it and getting to the depths of it, this most profound form of suffering, we'll be dealing with other areas of suffering en route, because this is what the book of Job has been written for. I said that there were other ancients. It seems as though the actual ethos of the book of Job goes back to the patriarchal period, some 2,000 years BC. But there were previous books written in the similar sort of style of a kind of dialogue and interaction where the case is put for suffering and then the answer given and then all the things that interact on those levels in the Egyptian writings. And also in the Sumerian, Babylonian area writings, in the Akkadian writings. So this is not a unique problem. It is one that has been with the human race for century after century, in fact, millennium after millennium. And it's as we sometimes compare the book of Job to these ancient writings, and we see a similar sort of style of putting the complaint and then the answer to the complaint and then further complaint, we discover the uniqueness of Job. Job is unique in that it's not just simply two people interacting like the rest of ancient literature. There are four offerings given, as you mostly know, through the three friends and the angry young man, four altogether, who try to give some answer to Job. And this is a unique part of Job's contribution to this whole inquiry. Secondly, unlike again the ancient literature that I've referred to, of which there's one is even called the Babylonian Job. That's the way that scholars have named it. It's not the title of the book. But even though that we look at those books, we don't find what we find in the book of Job, which is that every now and again, Job uses some of the poetry of worship. Some incredible bits of worship are found there that are evoked by creation. And there are parallels even to Genesis, and parallels to, of course, Proverbs and other books, Jeremiah, but in particular, chapters 40 to 55 of Isaiah have got parallel understanding and ideas that you find developed in the book of Job. And so Job's contribution and the biblical contribution is one in which somehow or other worship, or what you would scholarly call the cultic area of life, as well as the apologetic and the rational area of discussing this subject, come together. And many of us have discovered when we are suffering that although we may have had a pretty good apologetic grasp of the problem, it is far more the actual experience of God that is discovered and is opened up to us when we worship, when we open our hearts and still go on loving God in the midst of the pain, that something of revelation takes place. I remind you again of the better translations of Romans 8:28. It isn't just simply all things work together for good, inevitably, and that God makes everything work together for good. Far better to translate all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. And in the middle of our tragedy, if we can go on worshipping like Job does, even in the midst of his objections and protestations and his pain, which he cries out, if somehow or other we can go on worshipping, which is the clue, which is the key to loving, adoring the creator of heaven and earth, adoring the God that we've seen in Christ, if we can do that, then the promise is that for those who will love God in the midst of all things that can be thrown at us, then there will be something that God gets out of it. That is the way to translate. It's not just simply, well, God will get something out of it anyway. It is to go on loving God, to get the most out of this situation. That's why worship peppers the book of Job in a way that none of the other ancient literature did. It's not the full answer to suffering, but it's the beginning of getting some pragmatic answer. That when we worship, and of course we're particularly in our Christian faith, helped and encouraged in worship, because we have a cross at the very heart of our message. And a suffering God is a terrific stimulus to go on worshipping ourselves when we are suffering. The cross of Calvary, the God who is willing to suffer, is the God who is willing to suffer with us when we suffer, and therefore to illuminate in the midst of it all. Tragic to go into suffering and have no God to turn to who can meet us and empathize with us. But we've got one that can. And that's why, as I say, this particularly unique contribution in Job, it's worth noting down, if you're trying to make some notes, it's worth noting down that this book is peppered with worship. Very important to keep a grasp on. I know Job says all sorts of things, terrible things. God's doing this to me. God's beating me up. God is unjust. I wish I could come before him and I'd argue out this case. Yet, do you remember at the very end, God says, everything that Job has said about me is true. What? All that sort of stuff? And what God means, of course, is that what Job was actually saying was that if God is like these theologians are telling me he is, then he is a tyrant and he's not worthy of respect and love. But I can't believe that he is that kind of a God. And therefore I will from time to time in the midst of my agony and pain give us some beautiful description of the worship of the Creator God. And I will try to go on worshipping, because that is the key word in this book for loving. And that's the way that we begin to feel our way into the heart of Job as he suffers. Now, Job did not suffer, of course, because he was a sinful man. That is going to come up in all of the four attacks that the theologians bring to bear on Job. Remember, Job, of course, has got terrific physical things. I've picked out some here. He's got a kind of an itch, a disfigurement, sores that are soaking and oozing, sores of worms. He's got, it's like chills that make him shiver, shriveling skin, eyes red with weeping. He's got diarrhea, sleeplessness, delirium, nightmares, choking, bad breath, emaciation, excruciating pain. We shouldn't smile, but the whole list is there if you go through it carefully. He's going through that kind of physical suffering, but you know where the greatest pain is? The greatest pain comes when he fears that he has lost God. It is the spiritual agony that wrecks through his spirit, which of course is in relationship to his physical condition. But when he fears that he's lost God, because the theologians are working on him, may I put it that way? I was toying with the idea, when you see my structure go up on the thing, which no doubt one or two of you will want to copy down, whether to say it's the philosophy of the friends, or the philosophy of the angry young man, or the philosophy that God gives. But in the end, I chose rather the theology. It is the pain of the theology that is pressed upon him in his pain and his suffering that gives him the greatest agony. Because their particular theology says that God is absent, God is not with you, God is against you, you are a sinner, God cannot have dealings with you. That's what causes him more pain than anything else. Now these things, of course, will be underlined in the 4 days as we start to tackle the text of the book. But in order just to find our way in with one or two more generalities, I would like to say that the one place of Job which is quoted in the New Testament, it's worth making a note of this one, is Romans chapter 11, verse 35. You'll remember that James uses Job as an illustration of his life and his patience and perseverance though many people think he was very far from patient. But in Romans chapter 11, there is a quotation. And the quotation is in these words, Romans 11 and verse 35. Who has first given to him that it might be paid back to him again? But I want to see it, I want us to see it in its context. Because if you find a New Testament writer taking a verse, even if it's only one verse out of a whole book, and putting it into a New Testament context, the hermeneutic principle is you take the rest of the book in with it. In other words, you've got to interpret that quote in the light of where it came from. And where it came from, you have to interpret in the light of its whole context, which is the book of Job as a complete thing. And where we've got to in Romans chapter 11, believe it or not, is the real climax of the book. Well, it's one of the climaxes. I'm sorry about this, because I know that how I wander around these things and keep coming back, but I hope I'm going to be true to my subject. But Romans keeps going around in cycles. And something is introduced, and then it's developed again a bit later on, and then it's developed a bit later on. And it starts to build all the way through the book. It's not just a flat kind of theological compendium where you start at the beginning and work through the end. It keeps on reproducing itself and getting deeper every time it goes, in cycles. And when we get to Romans chapter 11, we haven't dealt with a kind of an appendix, which 99% of the commentaries you read will tell you, a kind of a tract about Israel between chapters 9 and chapter 11. We have reached the climax, in a sense, or one of the climaxes, and this climax goes in this beautiful bit of worship, just as we've been talking. We've been saying that suffering and pain and problem and depths of things need worship. Verse 33. Oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom. Book of Job is a book of wisdom. The book of both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. The book of wisdom says that the knowledge of God is the beginning of fear of the Lord is the beginning of the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments, and unfathomable are his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who became his counselor? Or who has first given to him that it might be paid back to him again? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen. That is a magnificent bit of worship of the ultimate wisdom and the truth and the purposes and the ways of God. His ways are untrackable, and we've been tracking them through chapters 9 to 11. His thoughts are past finding out, but how deep is the knowledge and the wisdom of God? And here the book of Job comes in. And all that Job has got to say about the ways and the untrackable ways of God must be read into that verse which is being quoted. It's quoted from possibly two places in Job. The first and the most obvious one is chapter 41 of Job, verse 11. Job chapter 41 and verse 11. Who has given to me that I should repay him? Who is able to repay God? Whatever is under the whole of heaven is mine. You can't pay God off with anything. Look also in chapter 35 and verse 7. In chapter 41, of course, it was God speaking. In chapter 35 and verse 7, it's Elihu. And Elihu is an interesting addition to the theologians, because he perhaps gets a few more things right than the other three do. Not everything, but some things. And in verse 7, if you are righteous, what do you give him? Or what does he receive from your hand? God doesn't owe you anything. Everything is his anyway. And that, in a sense, is corroborated by God himself in chapter 41. And he almost repeats it. Who has given to me that I should repay him? And so there is a sense in which all that Job has got to work out in his life is then going to be dropped in at the end of the wonderful argument that Paul has concerning the ways of God as he writes to the Romans and gets to the 11th chapter. Remember that when you're trying to study Romans. Terribly important to to read the text in the context and put it when it's quoted in the same way as it was meant when it was used in the Old Testament itself. Now, the underlying philosophy of the book of Job is that the question, is it better to have a God of love who runs the universe than having a God who is just simply might and almightiness? You've probably heard this contrast in the whole debate concerning the problem of suffering. If God is a loving God, and if God is an almighty God, wouldn't a loving God, having all might, do something about my little girl when she was ill? Or do something about the tragedy with which I began talking about that 12-year-old in a German camp and the SS officer? Wouldn't God have done something about Jessica and Holly? If God is all-loving and loved those children, surely he is almighty, and almighty love would actually act. Now that is the tension, put in a nutshell, concerning the problem of suffering and the justice of God. Are you with me? How can God be all-loving and almighty? And so the question that is being raised in the book of Job is, which sort of God is fit to sit on the throne of the universe? Many of us, if we were honest and analysed ourselves carefully and looked at the kind of politics that we espouse, would say we believe in the might is right God. Because might is right gets things done. And it doesn't allow all sorts of things to happen, and it slaps them down and finishes them off. This kind of wishy-washy sentimentalism of a God of love allows all sorts of things to go astray. And so we all go for, well, a lot of us, for the almighty God, because he can run the show better. Of course, we think very simplistically about the show, but we say that. We'd rather have sort of the law and the order and the righteousness of being slapped down, and anybody gets out of line, zap, they're summarily judged, and that problem no longer goes on, and neither can it perpetuate itself in other people with pain. We like that kind of thing, don't we? That's why we somehow or other find it difficult and say, but if you're all loving, if you're a loving father, surely if you had all that power, you would zap in and you would stop it all and change it all. It's the problem of suffering in a nutshell. It comes out in Camus' writing called La Peste, the plague, where in a North African town, a plague runs through the town and people are dying like flies. And the humanist doctor, who doesn't believe in God, and the rat catcher work together. The rat catcher goes after the source of the plague, and the doctor tries to deal with the pain in people's lives. Whereas the priest, representing, as far as Camus understands what the Bible is saying, the priest stands over on the other side and says, well, it's the will of God. He made the rats, he made the disease, he made human bodies to submit to them, and therefore the will of God be done. Now that is a caricature, of course, but it's a caricature that we deserve because of what we put over to European Christianity, particularly Europe. It's a caricature because we've said, you know, God is working in all these things. He's got some more majestic and divine purpose behind letting that little girl die of typhoid. He's got some great weaving that's going on. You can only see the back of the tapestry. You can't see the picture in the front. There's some greater and divine purpose that's being worked out. And that kind of answer is not a satisfactory one in the present conditions of the 21st century, if you want to present Christianity. Neither is it a true one. And it is not a Bible one. As much as we've often heard it put over to try and comfort those who have been bereaved or who need some source of stimulation in their difficulty, in their pain. So how do we bring the two things together? This book is going to deal with it. It seems, although the word love is only, I think, once used probably in the whole book, and it's certainly not in the context of loving God, the word worship is. And I've tried to make the case already that to worship is to love. It's a kind of love-making to God. And worship is expressing our devotion, our adoration, the wonder of belonging to Him and who He is. And the issue turns around like this. That God is presented as a God of love, but He is not a God who can do anything and everything at any point, at any time. And we don't like that, and we've purged it. We've purged the reverse of it from our theology, and we want to hang on to the fact that God can do anything. In fact, we've got little songs to sing about it. I won't sing it to you now, because you would suffer even more. But God can do anything but fail kind of idea. And of course, it's the certain truth in its proper context that we can rightly say such matters. But I made a silly kind of illustration on Saturday night that the God, of course, who is being besought by the farmer because we need some rain, and the God who is being sought after by ichthys campers because we don't want the rain, those two things alone, multiplied by 6 billion, causes a colossally complex problem to the Almighty God. That if it was only a matter of a prayer and a matter of putting our case before the Lord, it in itself is a massive, huge problem of running this universe and getting everything sorted out. And you might appeal to Him and say, you don't love us because we're not going to get a harvest next year, or you don't love us because we've had a bad holiday and it was wet all the time, or whatever. And that kind of trivial rejection is something which we're going to see dealt with as Job goes through his problem. It's something like this. Job is a very, very good man. In fact, he's one of the best of men. If you look into chapter 1 and verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless, upright, fearing God and turning away from evil. 7 sons, 3 daughters born to him, his possessions, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 cattle, camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And it came about when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, we see that Job's religion was not just skin deep. Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings, interceding for them, substituting vicarious prayers, and he prayed for them all, for Job said, perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually, not just a one-off. He was always praying. He prayed for his family. He prayed their protection. He prayed that God would bless them and forgive them if they had in some way been inadvertently cursed him. Verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, where do you come from? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from roaming up and down the earth and walking on it. Now that's a rather snide response, of course, but it does indicate something of the character that's being introduced to us. There is a certain irresponsible randomness about Satan. There is that within the universe which appears to be extremely random. Does it not? And you've only got to touch into quantum physics for a moment or two to understand the randomness of the way that particles seem to operate. At the base of life and at the base of the universe, there is not a nice, neat Newtonian order where cause and effect are always seemingly playing a perfect part. Our insight should be used to help us get deeper into the heart of God. God has got a universe which is terribly random. Oh yes, statistically you may be able to drop through rules. 80% of the particles will bounce in a particular direction if you bombard an atom. But 20%, who knows where each one will go? Where have you been, Satan? Wandering up and down the earth, minding my own business, doing my own thing. And this is not just simply a snide remark to make us smile as we look at a book of jokes, because this is not a book of jokes. I haven't given any jokes yet. I've left them for David to give. and we're still recovering from it. It isn't a book of jokes. It isn't a trivial thing. This is profundity in concrete language. The kind of universe in which we live has a supernatural power that seems to be moving around doing something which God even has to inquire and say, what have you been up to? Well, I've been wandering around doing this, that and the other. First important factor to begin to get a grip on. If this is the revelation of God, let's take serious notice of it. Evil appears like that, doesn't it? Doesn't it appear random? Pain and suffering and so on. An old friend of mine that many of you remember, Ian Thomas, was in the war. There was one man each side of him. A bomb goes off. He not only captured, I think it was something like 32 Italians with one pistol, but the two men each side of him died. He just had one finger knocked off. That's why all his followers, because he's trained many, many young men, they all preach like that. Because Ian Thomas preached like that with one finger, top of one finger missing. But why? And he might say, well, God sort of preserved me and used me. And what about the other two fellows? Couldn't God have used them? Didn't their families cry when his family didn't have to? You know? And there is a randomness, an arbitrariness that we've got to come to terms with in life. And it's no good just simply making out that everything is ticking according to God's mind and will, as I said on Saturday night, because he otherwise wouldn't have told us to pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Because if his will was always being done on earth, there would be no need to pray that his will might come and be done. So Satan's been walking up and down the earth and doing his thing, and there is a kind of council meeting going on. I don't know what else to call it, really. The council, is it, of God? These people got special or particular responsibilities, and they meet before God from time to time. But here it appears to be presented that way. Don't think, you've got to think in concrete terms. But don't think, therefore, it's childish. What other ways can we talk about the supernatural movements that are taking place in these wonderfully complex universe in which we live? It is representing something which is as real as when Jesus gives us a parable. It's just as real as when we talk about angels throwing Babylon into the sea. It is a reality that you've got to have a concrete image in your mind to begin to grasp, and simply to translate it into a meaningless, scientific, washed-out parable picture language doesn't in any way enhance it. In fact, it generally confuses it. This is a book for all times, for all cultures, in all places. And it tells us if we're going to try and understand the kind of universe which we're in, we've got to understand some kind of spiritual, supernatural council taking place in which Satan has some sort of entry. And it's going to explain something about the sort of universe we're in. The very fact that I've already brought up that he wanders around the earth, roaming where he wills, has brought in a profound concept. There is arbitrariness, there is a randomness at the base of the universe, and that is going to affect the way in which we are going to handle the things that happen to us in life. Now, you could say that God starts all the trouble here, of course, because he is so thrilled about Job. Do you believe it? He's so thrilled that when he finds somebody who is blameless and upright, doesn't mean to say he's perfect in the wrong sense, obviously Job has done a few sins or two, but he repents and he gets things worked out. He's blameless, he's upright, he fears God, and he turns away from evil. And God's thrilled about Job. There was a day when he saw his son, and his son was being baptized. And God was thrilled. Look, he said, that's my son, that's my boy. And he was so thrilled he fell out of heaven, at least the Holy Spirit did, and dropped upon him, and dropped upon Jesus. Because God is looking for a man. He's looking for a true human. He's looking for that creation which he made to be conformed to the image of his son. And when he found it in Jesus, his heart just goes out with great euphoria. Oh, wonderful. That's my son. That's my child. That's my boy. That's the sort of man I wanted. And in those 2,000 years before Jesus came, he looked out and he saw Job, and he was excited about Job. And Satan sees he's excited about Job. And although God realizes some problems are going to arise, he can't still contain it because Satan's already picked it up, because God is real and God has got integrity and you can pick it up and he can't hide it. He says, yeah, you kind of enjoy Job, don't you? But does Job serve God for nothing? Doesn't he get so much out of it? Say, well, that's the kind of Christianity that so often I've been reared in, that if you obey God, you get a good time. If you don't obey God, then you may have a rough time. So doesn't he get a lot out of it? You've given him all this blessing of servants and children and crops and cattle and who knows what. Does Job serve God for nothing? Okay? That's at the heart of this whole battle. If you turn, look on a bit to chapter 2, verse 3, you'll see it says, the last phrase, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. That is exactly the same thing. It's the same Hebrew word. God being served by Job, and does he do it for nothing? And you ruined him without cause is like for nothing, for nothing, for nothing. Do you remember Jesus saying they hated me without a cause? Now, I'm going to give you a rather boring bit of rundown on philosophy. Sorry about that. But it's just helpful for us to see this in the context of philosophy, because it affects our thinking. In the 17th century, rationalism arose with Descartes. Descartes shut himself in a kind of a Swedish stove, shut the door on it, and tried to blank out of his mind anything of the world that was around him for sheer, pure, rational thought. And he sat there and he thought and thought and thought. And he came up with all sorts of wonderful ideas. But you see, when you think about isosceles triangles, which you often do, I'm sure, then you will remember that the angles at the base of an isosceles triangle are always equal, and you think of a perfect, but there's no such thing as a perfect isosceles triangle. They don't exist in the real world, but they do exist in your head. They don't exist in the real world. And so rationalism, with its perfection of unaffected thinking, produces an unreal world. And so the next phase was that in the 18th century, led by David Hume and a couple of clergymen, Locke and Berkeley, empiricism came into being. And all that empiricism really added was, it's no good just sitting there thinking. You've got to do your thinking on the basis of what is. And what is observed and weighed and measured. And you weigh and measure things, and this is the scientific philosophy of which we're all affected with, until postmodernism takes us beyond it. But we've all been affected by weighing and measuring and observing. And then we do our thinking. Very sensible. Because then you are, at least apparently, dealing with the real world. Or are we? Because if you happen to be jaundiced or something, or had it, you will look through your spectroscope and the colours will get all confused with yellow. And not always through our sense impressions do we get the exact equivalent of what we're actually looking at out there. And anyway, what we're looking at out there, we only have to have an act of faith to believe is the same thing that we're seeing in here. Can't prove it. You just got to accept it. And that's empiricism. And so empiricism says we've got to weigh and measure things. And the next lot that come along are the Romanticists. And they react even further to rationalism and to empiricism. And they say it's the impact that it has in our feelings and how we feel about things. It's much more important. Reality is how we are being affected by those things rather than the things themselves. And after that, along come the existentialists, who say, no, it's what I choose to put in first place that's important. I choose to act like a waiter. I choose to act like a mountaineer. I choose to play the man about town. I choose to be the pretty young thing, or whatever it is. And you make your choice, and you play act, and you live in that realm. Now, all these philosophies have moved through the last 300 years, 400 years. And at the heart, the end product is what ultimately, absolutely, and finally is real. Rationalism leaves me inside my head, and that can't be the final criterion. I think, therefore I am. Empiricism leaves me sometimes confused, because I now know that it makes a difference who is gathering the scientific data and observing the affairs that are going on around us. And then my emotions might as well be accepted as the only thing that really is the reality there. And then if I choose to put hatred in the first place, or if I choose to put a criterion, a benchmark of wisdom, or if I put a benchmark of happiness, then I measure things by that and live by that. And then comes along postmodernism that says there is nothing to measure anything by, because it's all virtual reality. It's not reality at all, it's just virtual. You can create just the same sex feelings by looking at pictures and television programs, and you can create just all those same romantic feelings about hatreds when you see the news and the terrible things going on, and it's all virtual reality. It's not real at all. And we're not the first people to deal with this. We've dealt with it in sophisticated 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century philosophy. But we've reached a place where most people have abandoned the search. And they say there is nothing ultimately behind anything. But what we've got here in the first chapters of the book of Job is a pulling back the veil of what is ultimately behind the universe, and it comes to us by revelation from God. Because Wittgenstein was not wrong when he said, if there is any meaning to anything that happens on the universe, if there is any meaning to anything anywhere at any time, the meaning must come from outside all that is and is happening, and it must come in and give its explanation to us within what's happening and the things that are going on in the universe. If there is any meaning to everything that's happening, anything that goes on, it can be measured, it must come from the outside to the inside. The revelation of God is essential for ultimately laying hold of the truth of what is. And this picture in the beginning of the book of Job is showing us, Job didn't even know it. Job didn't know what had happened in the first two chapters. He's showing us what is going on behind the scenes, from outside to the inside. From the reality of God, which is eternal, into this small little bit of temporal functioning of energy and matter. And the meaning is being put in by God in revelation like we've got here. Job is shown to stimulate the excitement of God because he is a righteous and blameless person. We tend to think, well, there are 6 billion of us anyway. Who cares whether somebody's a bit more righteous than somebody else? God does, and this is the revelation of a God who loves the world and is looking for the best in the world and wants us to experience the best because he loves us. And the temptation that is brought by Satan to Job is, you don't really think that Job, or is to God in actual fact, but you don't really think that Job serves you for what you are, love. He serves you for what he can get out of you. And altruistic love does not exist. What we call Calvary love, with no strings attached, is a non-entity. It is an unreality. Job only serves you because of what he gets out of you. He does not really love you. There is no such thing as pure worship in the universe. Now, what can God do? God, of course, being almighty, can turn round to Satan and give him a clip round the ear of whatever they do in the heavenly council of God. Call the committee to order. Order, order. Satan, out. And give him a, you know. And as he creeps out with a sneer on his face, everybody in the council room, including God, will know that he really has won. Because what he is saying is, you really believe in the same philosophy as I believe in. You believe might is right. You don't believe in almighty love because it doesn't exist. You really run this universe in the same way as I would. And therefore I've got as much right to run it as you. That's the contention that's going on. Who's going to run the show? And Satan is saying, my method, might is right, is far more efficient. It gets things done. It will really make the whole thing swing. Instead of this messed up, rather grey area of the world where all sorts of problems exist, simply because you want to keep on to this almighty love business, and it doesn't really exist, it's just a play acting, and we've got to get back to reality. Got the idea? That is the war that lies behind this universe. That is the war that we're engaged in every time we're tempted to do, or we give in, and Job didn't, to curse God, to curse the situations, to curse the scene, and say that such a love does not exist. And I'm not prepared to give it back to God unless God gives me all sorts of goodies. Let me make it more poignant. Here's a man whose wife is dying with cancer. He sits there and holds her hand. He goes through the pain with her. In fact, sometimes he feels more pain in his soul than she does in her body. For the agony and the losing of her, and the fact, too, that she is going through something that he can't change and do anything about. He gets absolutely nothing out of his wife except pain. Doesn't wash his clothes, give him any food to eat. We're an old-fashioned family. My wife does those things. She won't let me in the kitchen, in actual fact. I'm a pretty good cook, really, but nobody ever knows that. And I'm going to keep it that way. Can't give him any cuddles. He gets absolutely nothing out of her except pain and agony. You'd say that man loved his wife. If, on the other hand, he popped off and played fast and loose with the woman next door, well, she gives me nothing now. What do I get out of this? Have you not heard that in modern romantic plays? I get nothing out of this. That's because we've lost the philosophy that comes from God. That is that almighty love sits on the throne of the universe, and almighty love goes through these kinds of experiences, and it's all being spelled out to us in this very dramatic kind of strong concrete picture. You would say that man did not love his wife. You might be, avant-garde, sociologically developed, politically correct, and say, he's got to have his sexual fulfillment somewhere, and so forth and so on. But you wouldn't say, honestly, that that was love. No human being would say to leave and abandon his painful wife who is dying and in agony would be in any way the way that love is expressed. Love is expressed by empathy, by identification, by moving into the scene with the other one, by going down the road of death as far as you possibly can and standing at the doorway until at last it's goodbye. That is what love does. That is what love is like. And you get absolutely nothing out of it. And if there is not some point in time and space where you get nothing out of your obedience to God and your seeking to serve him, then maybe God has never seen fit to let you into such a situation to justify him, because that's what we're doing. And to justify that almighty love is the only final answer for the meaning of this universe and getting somewhere to the problem of answering what our pain and our tears and our laughs and our joys and our relationships and the things that go on in our experience. If there is such a God lying behind the universe who is almighty love, then he is worth loving with everything that we are, whether we get nothing out of it or not. If you only love somebody for what you get out of them, you haven't really touched into altruistic Calvary love yet. That is what Job is going to demonstrate. That is where Job is going to take us eventually. But he doesn't know that this is going on behind the scenes. We do. We have the advantage, in a sense, on him in this battle, because we've not only seen it in the first two chapters, but we've seen it in our Lord Jesus Christ. We've seen it when he cries, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's standing just in that very place where he is getting absolutely nothing out of it except pain, agony, distress, torment, hell itself. And it's in that place he still goes on loving and trusting, Father, into your hand I commit my spirit, that we see the final triumph of this battle. And that battle is being worked out through his body, the church, day in and day out. So back to the text, verse 7. The Lord said to Satan, where'd you come from? Satan answered, from roaming around the earth and walking around on it. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on the earth, blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. Satan answered and said to the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing, without a cause? Can I just emphasize that for a moment? Jesus said, they hated me without a cause. Some people say there has to be a cause for everything. There has to be a cause why this person is a mugger and a murderer. There has to be a cause that he's twisted up in his sexuality and he destroys young children. There has to be a cause. Ultimately, there is no cause. Rationalism always wants a cause. Empiricism says there must be a cause for every action, a cause and reaction. There has to be a cause. But the cause ultimately is found within you and within me, in demons and in angels and in Satan and in God. The ultimate cause is within us. And this, often, Christian philosophy has been unwilling to accept. And we have perpetrated this sociological disaster whereby everything that happens in society is because it's being caused by grandmother who used to beat you with a frying pan, or you didn't win the pools when you were going to buy some house down on the Thames, or whatever it was. There has to be a cause that's caused this terrible disruption. I tell you, the fundamental cause is ourselves. Of course, it may be helped on the way once we start on a pathway and things are happening to us. But the ultimate cause is within the human being. You can treat two, and these sort of things have been attempted. Twins, even. Exactly the same. And the final product in our lives can be totally different. Because it is to do with the cause that takes place inside us. What choices are we making? In the end, God has no right to judge the human race and to judge you individually and me individually unless the cause is found somewhere in me. There may be contributing factors en route that we can peel off and say, yes, well, I did have a bad childhood, or this thing did happen to me. But ultimately, it is my own response to the things that are happening and my own choices in my own will that makes me legitimately brought into the judgment of God and for God to pronounce a judgment on me. I believe in human free will. I am over the top and lunatic about human free will. Because if we do not accept that we have a will in which we've made the choices, and you are the man, as Nathan said to David, you are the man. Unless I accept and point the finger at myself and accept my responsibility in the things that have happened, the things that are done, I will never find a solution and I will never see change in my life. It's when I say that I am the man and I need God's help to change and call upon God, that is where I begin to find answers in my life. And that's when I become a real human being instead of a bit of putty or a bit of a wet flannel that sort of flaps its way around, or a Charlie Brown that always sits on the fence and will never make up his mind about anything. God save us from this kind of pathetic sociological conditioning which is sending us all into the hell of our own experience, rather than to raise us up with human beings who look the world in the face and say, I may be the only person who believes this, but I'm going to live by it and die by it. That is the calling that Jesus brings onto the human being. It gives you a dignity that belongs to your godlikeness. For God makes those kind of decisions. God makes those kind of choices. And the incredible thing is that we're forever, in our theology and philosophy, been trying to remove off the scene the responsibility of the human being to rise up in the dignity of being made in the image of God, whereby, instead of blaming everybody else, the serpent did it to me, or the woman you gave me did it to me. Huh? See, it's all there in the beginning. It's all there in the Bible. And instead of saying, I am the man, I did it. Well, the woman almost said that. Not quite, but almost. The man was miles off. You know, it's that miserable woman you're giving us. Wouldn't be like this if it weren't for her. And we stand up and play the man and we say, and if you notice this is what happens to Job at the end. Stand on your feet, Job. Gird up your loins. I want to speak to you, man to man, as it were. It's God to man. And it's treating the human being with the dignity of being human. To be human is not to be a lump of putty that has been conditioned by thousands of years of evolution and has tipped us out at the end. It is not to be standing around saying, well, everything is ordained by God and it's all happening just as God has arranged it. It is a matter of standing up before God and in the light of God saying, God help me, I want to choose to do the right. I want to be those that follow in the conformity of Jesus. See the idea? It's there at the heart. It's the heart of the issue is there. That's why some of the things we might say sometimes don't seem to fit in with a lot of popular theology, but in actual fact it's terribly important that we start to come to terms with them. And it colours everything in the end. All the truths of Scripture begin to be coloured by the reality of my responsibility, because I'm made in God's image. And that's where the impact into the world is coming from. So, verse 9. We've emphasized already. Here we are again. Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him? Blessed the work of his hands, the possessions have increased. Put now forth your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. There's an awful lot of cursing going on in, well, threat of it, in Job chapters 1 and 2. Look at verse 5. In case they curse God in their hearts. Verse 11, surely he'll curse you to your face. Verse 5, he will curse you to your face. Verse 9, his wife says, curse God and die. Chapter 3, verse 1, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Still didn't curse God. And in verse 11, there are sort of two words for curse, really, or take an oath. He will surely is surely I warrant you. Surely I owes that he will curse you. So there's an awful lot to do with the mouth. And I don't know when my wife's doing her seminar on cursing and blessing. Is it today? It's terribly important to come to terms with the reality of our speech. I've said that we are made like God in that we can make choices. That's our godlikeness. I would assert, too, that one of the fundamental differences between men and animals is the ability to articulate truth. We have mouths that can actually speak. And since speech begins with God, God spoke, and the universe comes into being, chapter 1 of Genesis, it's important, again, to underline the godlikeness of the human being is in our speech. And our speech is terribly, 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 terribly important. We're either contributing to the powerful effect, and you know the silly adage, sticks and stones may hurt my bones, but words will never hurt me. That is absolutely trite nonsense. Words are much more effective in the universe than anything else. And if I speak cursing, negatives, and bring destruction into people's hearts and minds and spirits, it is far more devastating in the end than anything I might have done to their bodies. If, on the other hand, I speak blessing, blessing in essence is eulogia, it means beautiful words. If I speak blessing into people's lives, there rises up and flowers up within them the ability to achieve or to come to what I've been saying and achieve the things that we're talking about. Somebody in this camp came up to me and thanked me for words I said to him after he'd fallen into gross sin. And, sorry, I'm quoting myself now. I shouldn't really do this, should I? But I said to him, not only go and sin no more, but I told him to go out and play the man and never do that again, but live and do something for God. And he's here today, rich with the experience, and he just wanted to come and tell me what difference it made that in no way did I bring condemnation. Jesus didn't come to condemn. He came to bring people back on track and then start to aspire to the perfections that we have in Christ. Whether we achieve them or not is another matter, but to at least be moving in that direction. We need words of blessing not words of cursing. The earth is filled with curse. That is why we are in a serious business. I don't know whether there's a professional journalist here or not, but we're in a very serious business if we're in journalism. In a very serious business if we're a politician and we get reported all over the place. Words are destroying this world or else they're blessing it. And the curse that comes is through our perception of who God is and what he's like. If God is this God of love and we want to respond and go on loving, whatever, we will add to the positive benefits of the earth by what we say. Well, just a quick one, because our time is virtually gone for this morning, I should try and sum up the end of chapter 1 there. The Sabaeans attacked. Sorry, the messengers came and told the story. The Sabaeans, they're from the south. The fire of God fell, probably lightning from the west where the storms came from over the sea. The Chaldeans from the north came in three bands. And then in verse 19, a great wind came across the wilderness. The enemy clearly is disclosed in this revelation from God as having the ability to use certain parts of the framework of this universe. Of course, you say he has had a word from God that he can do it. And although you might get rather tired of it in some commentaries on the book of Job, you will find that Reformed theologians are forever trying to make out the point that Satan does nothing but God allows him to do it, etc., etc. Well, of course God is sovereign in that sense. The whole show wouldn't exist unless God brought it into being, and he owns the whole thing. But he also owns the whole thing and gives these areas of responsibility in which we can exercise and use our wills. And Satan can use his will, even if he had to ask for a particular permission. But I don't even know whether he has to do that. This is a concrete picture to show us the relationship between God, Satan, the supernatural world, the affairs that are going on the earth. And of course, God ultimately has his hand to contain and to restrain. But in this particular instance, we see that the enemy can use various affairs that we, therefore, wouldn't pray about unless we believed it. We wouldn't pray about the weather if we didn't believe that God could put his hand on it and Satan can put his hand on it. Would we? Wouldn't pray about anything in the end, because it's all going to happen anyway. But that is the picture. These wills are interacting with one another. I didn't make the point, but can you take another deep one this morning? Or have you had enough? Verse 11, put forth your hand, says Satan, and touch all that he has, and he'll surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, behold, all he has is in your hand. Same word in the Hebrew. Power, it may be in some texts. Same again in verse 5, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he'll curse you. Verse 6, behold, is in your hand. See, a lot of the things that Job says are blaming God's hand. God's doing this to me. God's pushing me down in the mire. God smashes my life. God has treated me in this way. And God says, yes, everything you said about me was right, because that wasn't me, it was Satan. It was Satan's hand that was upon him. All right? And yet here it said, well, you know, it's God's hand, but now it's Satan's hand. Who destroyed the firstborn of Egypt? Well, God destroyed the firstborn. But it said the angel of death came and destroyed them. Who sent Nebuchadnezzar? Who brought Nebuchadnezzar as a judgment on Israel? Well, Nebuchadnezzar is called God's servant, but he wasn't up to much, was he, Nebuchadnezzar? And then God says, and I am going to judge Babylon. So he couldn't have been too pleased about the way things were going. Who put Jesus on the cross? We say, well, of course, it was predeterminate counsel and wisdom of God. And it pleased the Lord to bruise him. But it was with the hands of wicked men that Jesus was put on the cross. I could go on giving you illustrations. Who moved David to number Israel? King says it was God. The same passage in Chronicles, same Hebrew word, verb, says it was Satan. And the only way you can reconcile apparent contradictions is to realize that ultimately, as we see in this revelation here, God the Creator is behind all things. keeps them all running. Keeps you going. Keeps me going. Even into the lunch hour. Keeps Satan running. Keeps demonic forces alive and well. He is the first cause of all things. If you want to put it that way. Gives life to all. But if one of those people that God keeps going pushes you over a precipice, and you just about to hit the bottom, if it comes strawberry jam, and you say, this is God's gravity that's killing me, it's a little bit unreasonable when, of course, it was the wretched fellow up top who pushed you over. And the interaction of God, the ultimate cause, and the immediate causes which our choices and our wills operate in, is something that we have to read into the text whenever we see this apparent sort of contradiction taking place. Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. If only you knew the day of your visitation. But now your house is left to you desolate. And the armies of the Romans came, and it was the judgment of God, but at the same time it broke the heart of God. And the foul things that the Romans did in destroying them, throwing the babies, and like the Babylonians, smashing their heads against the wall. It is not the ordination of God that that should be done, but God is ultimately responsible for where evil activity takes over into evil areas and does its thing. That is the complexity of all these wills operating together. While God still holds the reins of the universe, and Satan is only functioning because he still lets him function. There's a good reason why he lets him function, because if Satan crawls out of this encounter with God, and the rest of the committee, which had more time to talk about the council, the committee of God, it's in quite a number of places in the Bible, includes lying spirits who will go and be a lying spirit, 1 Kings. Remember that, some of you? Know your Bible as well? It's in places too where, I like to think about it, sitting around a committee table, got the chairman there, and we stand in awe of the chairman, but boy, we're going to make our will known, and we're going to make our point known, and if we can wheedle away, we're going to get something done. And maybe we're letting Satan shout too loudly in God's ear in this committee, whereas a few more prayers would shout from the other side of the picture, using a concrete picture. And we'd start to see things happening, which would avert the injustices and the pain and the suffering that exist in this world. So say Job is a special case we're going to take up as we move along and understand why it is that he's suffering. But in the first place, it's because he's demonstrating that even if you get nothing out of loving God, that is the only way to live, and it's the only way that matters, and that's what true love is, and that's what sits on the throne of the universe. And we'd rather have altruistic Calvary love on the universe than we would have almighty power that's pushing everything around. That is the battle, and the church is called into that battle. And where God sees people in the church who are blameless and upright and seeking to live in the conformity of Christ, then the similar battle as Job sometimes takes place. You may be in that category. Most of us suffer because we're rather obtuse and self-willed and push our own thing the wrong way. But some of us suffer because we're standing here vindicating God before the heavenly realm and saying God is worth having anyway. And maintaining that that's what we want to run this show. We want almighty love to be the final preeminent thing in our life experience. I've made the point before, and I'll finish on this one. Don't you think it's rather remarkable, with all the historic Christian creeds that exist, there isn't one creedal statement that says, those magnificent things that are said in the Bible about God, God is love. And he's such love that he loved the world. Not one of them says that. They say all sorts of other good things. But there isn't one creed that thinks it's worth saying this most unique facet of Christian truth. That in the end, God is love. No other philosophy, religion in the world says that. Not that God is almighty and then perhaps a little bit down the line sometimes he's loving. It is that ultimately, fundamentally, when he judges, when he redeems, when he works in the universe, everything that he's doing, when he chastens us, it's all out of that great, huge, altruistic package of love which was adequately demonstrated when Jesus hung on the cross. And God says, I love you like that. And when we build on that in our lives, yes, either we're going to have some inconsistencies and we'll forget them and we'll just carry on and go on serving him anyway, or else we'll find those inconsistencies can be resolved through books like the book of Job, if we're willing to get deeply into them, as I hope in the next three sessions we will do so. But we've laid the foundations. This is what the battle is all about. It's a battle concerning Calvary love and the throne of God and the authority in this universe that I want to be a part of and share in and to live by, as opposed to any other authority of a love that pushes everything around, gets his own will done anyway, anyhow, and is ignoring the fact that he's made a universe with lots of independent wills that in the end can either choose the will of God or can choose to set up our own do-it-yourself kind of situation. Are you happy? You're beginning to get the ground of it. Mary's just starting, but that's where it all begins. We'll leave it there, I think, this morning.